Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21.
Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and the production of the AS21 Podcast Network. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
Proof is a play that knows nothing about math and everything about mental illness. Math in Proof is what Alfred Hitchcock called the MacGuffin, which means the device that moves the plot forward. It doesn't matter what it is. Proof barely mentions math. Where's the understanding or the atmosphere of the math it portrays? The same play could be about chess or sports. I don't know much about mathematics either. The last math I learned was when I was 3 years old and my grandfather taught me algebra. And since then, I've never learned any higher mathematics. If Proof mentioned math except in passing, they could have put anything right by me and I'd believe anything they tell me. Proof barely makes the effort, a couple of mathematical anecdotes and that's it. Higher mathematics isn't so essential that there needs to be great art about it. But if there's a great play about math, everybody agrees that it's Copenhagen by Michael Frayn about nuclear and theoretical physics. It recreates the mid-World War II meeting outside Copenhagen between the half-Jewish Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg, Bohr's former assistant and head of the Nazi nuclear program. The uncertainty of what they discussed mirrors the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that atoms and electrons are so small they can't be observed in their natural state because light's mere presence changes their movement. In the play, the principle is a metaphor for their relationship's uncertainty, their memory's uncertainty, our uncertainty about the meeting's purpose, our uncertainty about World War II's lived experience, the uncertainty of war, uncertain lives under totalitarianism, and the uncertainty of being itself. But I don't think the majority of characters in Proof have a last name, let alone do we ever know Proof's mathematician's discoveries. At the story's center is a relationship between a father and a daughter. The father is a mad genius, the daughter possibly as well. The father, Robert, is obviously modeled on John Nash, a Nobel mathematician with schizophrenia made famous by A Beautiful Mind. I hated that movie, loathed it. But even A Beautiful Mind tried to explain Nash equilibrium, even though mathematicians said they failed. Yet, as a case study of mental illness, Proof is one of the most convincing I've ever seen, and unlike math, I'm in a position to observe its veracity with expertise. I'm sure we'll get into reasons why as this podcast continues. What further compounds a disturbed mind are the vagaries of human behavior surrounding a mind's personhood. A disturbed mind, thoughts already compounded by mental and emotional delusion, contends with behaviors of people dealing with them whose true motives are never ascertained. There is no one worse at understanding others' motives than a person already beset by delusion. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't out to get you. And the motives of those who love the mentally ill are compounded by resentments, doubts, even exploitations. The vast majority of the mentally disturbed are wired to view their lives with excess negativity rather than positivity. So the petty betrayals of loved ones at their worst are exaggerated by our brains. Still further complicated by the inevitability that complaints about our treatment are written off as the illness's exaggeration rather than realistic complaints. I'm not sure I have ever seen a more admirable artistic rendering of this process than Proof, where vagaries of romance and family wear the mentally ill down until they resolve to live with as few attachments as possible because demanding anything more may ensure a horrific cocktail of grief and terror that lasts every day for months, years, even decades. The reciprocal to mental illness's ambiguities is the unfashionable notion that the cerebral overactivity of mental illness enables creative leaps which the more stable regard as otherworldly. Even though today's intelligentsia are as dissatisfied as ever, few notions are more disparaged today than one that suffering is a necessary part of inspiration and preparation. And this is a crucial point. Many non-creatives use the idea of the suffering artist to keep creatives in squalor. At its core, it's little different from the Sermon on the Mount's quote, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." This is the old justification used to keep Christian masses suffering while priests accumulate all the knowledge and wealth for themselves. Furthermore, the suffering creative is an excuse for powerful artists and intellectuals to behave abominably. So let me conclude by positing a different theory of the suffering artist. Not original, though I don't know its origin. An artist's suffering isn't what creates great art. Creativity's motive is often to create a distraction from suffering. The easiest way to stop a destructive obsession is a constructive obsession. Only someone in pain would endure the masochism of a perilous task. Psychologists sometimes speak of what they call depressive realism, meaning that depressed people, free from positive delusions, see the world more accurately. This strikes me as ass backwards. If the mentally ill see parts of the world more accurately, it's because their brains are wired excessively for that kind of reason to the detriment of other kinds. The obsession required for a brain to more accurately perceive things means that other perceptions go to seed, and that lack of perception severely damages a person's life circumstances, which depresses them. Creative people are different from uncreatives. Not worse, not better. It's certainly no excuse for creative people to behave badly, but because creative people are different, it causes their faults to be seen much more easily because there are far more non-creative types in the world, and their particular faults are far more easy to disguise. But a large part of your legacy is how you deal with people different from you, and the closest people different to most of you are creative people. They, more than anybody else, render your life's judgment for posterity. Be nice to them, because whether deliberately or accidentally, we creatives render all manner of creative means for ironic punishment.
Much of what happened, what is discovered now, will of course be secret. We will not be given the full answer.
This has been It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker, a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find this and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Copyright 2018, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?